You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
So I'm snowed in, yet there's no actual snow on the ground yet. It's just started to snow. But it's a snow day up here in Western Mass. I assume this storm is missing D.C.
There have been the surrounding areas have some worse than snow, which is ice. Mm. We're okay here in southern DMZ, but federal workers had 2-hour delay today.
So, oh, okay.
Because of this.
You know, I don't know if this is just me being old, but I feel like, you know, so almost all the snow days that happen now are called the day before. So it's not the 6 a.m., you know, call in the morning. They see the weather report. You know, I was told at 4 p.m. yesterday there's going to be a snow day. And I wonder if that is part better weather forecasting technology. Because this is a case where up here, the snow was not supposed to start till noon. So you would be able to get to school. It would be messy leaving school.
Yeah.
And I feel like when I was a kid, you would go to school on a day like that. You wake up, there's no snow on the ground, boom, you're going. If there's a problem later, you know, that's a problem later. And now
it was exciting. It was more fun. It was more exciting. Probably more dangerous also, exciting.
Well, I think it's a combination of better technology and lower threshold of risk, lower acceptance of risk and danger, which is combining to make us have more snow days and more quickly called snow days.
Are you saying that we are snowflakes because of this?
It's probably all for the good, but certainly on this as a telecommuter, a snow day is horrible. I mean, I don't know what people do when they go to the office. If you had a 2-income family, you know, what do you do on a snow day? Do you have emergency childcare help, or do you have to call and take a sick day yourself?
Yeah, but that's the problem is, if you have a nanny or an au pair who is on every day, then it doesn't matter because they're there every day. But by definition, if your kids are going to school, you don't – I mean, unless you have a younger child at home, by definition, if you're sending your kids to school, you wouldn't be employing somebody to be on call like on a random Tuesday or Wednesday. And so, yeah, I think this is a real problem, and I think it's under – I really think it's underrated. I don't think we talk enough about – this stuff and the impact it has on families, on work. And I'm guessing, I mean, I would just guess disproportionately moms are hit by this, but it impacts everybody.
Well, anybody who works out of the house,
yeah,
man or woman, it's gonna affect your day. I mean, if you're a freelancer, that's lost money if you can't get work done. And I remember when there was a huge snowstorm recently in New York City, and it was like a big snowstorm. Like, it was going to hit us too. Like, obviously, you'd have a snow day. It's a huge snowstorm. But it's so unusual for there to be snow days in New York City that I saw parents on Facebook saying, Mayor de Blasio, don't call snow. It was the mayor's call. You know, it wasn't like, I mean, here it's the superintendent's call. And it becomes a political decision that you are taking a chunk out of the city's economy for the day. That's such a massive school system, and that's weighing on that decision where it really should just be safety first.
Yeah. So I've also worked. You know, I love working at places that have like young, sort of younger people, the energy. But there's the downside to that is I remember like when I used to work at the Daily Caller in D.C., the average age there was like 23. And the average person lived like 2 blocks from the office, and they lived like in D.C. And I have 2 kids and live in Northern Virginia. But it's the kind of thing where it almost be there can be. They never put this external pressure on me, but there's always the whole like, you know, if you don't show up at the office, are people going to kind of think you're a wimp or that you're, you know, so like. You know, there is that kind of pressure that's I think put on parents sometimes that other people, you know, don't have.
Right. Well, let's shift gears to typical.
Well, let's just talk about that. I think we should do the whole show on this. This is more fun.
Special snow day episode.
It impacts me personally. unlike politics, I have a very strong opinions about these things. So,
but this is an important week. We're taping on Wednesday. There's a lot going on. We're 24 hours to shut down if they don't do a deal. The memo is still swirling. But before I get into any of that stuff, I was very fascinated by an interview that was on CNN with Chris Cuomo of Joe Biden. He had a long 20-25 minute interview, prime time, and that was followed up today by a Politico story detailing his very, very active midterm election politicking schedule. He plans to be traveling nonstop, getting involved in Senate races, House races, endorsing in primaries, although he stopped short of saying definitively he's going to run in 2020. But if you watch the CNN interview, which is ostensibly about his book, about his son, and they talked about Bo a lot, you can still see genuine sadness and grieving on the part of Joe Biden when he talks about it. I don't think it's phony in any way. I don't think it's being used for political gain. But it's on the surface. But at the same time, you can't ignore the fact that the emotional connection you make with Biden when he talks about it is politically advantageous for him. And Biden's been around long enough, I think, to be cognizant of that. And so there's a point towards the end of the interview where they're talking politics and not about Beau. And Biden saying how he's looking forward to seeing more Democratic names and faces come up. There's a lot of talent out there. And Chris Cuomo pushed him and said, who's better than you? And Biden pauses. And I assume the gears are in his head. No, if he gives an actual name, that's not helpful to him in 2020. But I think he sincerely says, your father. Your father was better than me.
That's a good answer.
And Chris gets a little choked up and says, you're going to make me upset. You know how Pop felt about you.
I'm sure outside the belt, people will talk about the swamp and the incestuousness of this, but I love this kind of stuff, right, to be honest with you.
Well, I think there are people who do look at it as like this sort of, here are two, political figures. I mean, Cuomo is a son of a political legend, and Biden, given have his inside talk. But when Biden does it, it doesn't feel that way as much. It feels more real. And I don't want to be in the position of being a Biden cheerleader. I don't think he's a lock for the nomination. I know there are a lot of Democrats out there who are very resistant to it and resistant to Bernie on somewhat similar grounds. We don't even know white guy as the nominee. But time and time again, I feel like I see Biden have those kind of moments which other candidates are probably not going to have.
There's an authenticity that he has.
And so it's an authenticity,
a likability. And I think it connects in middle America, obviously. I mean, in a way that some of the more polished candidates you just can't do.
And there's a quote in the Politico story which talks about how Biden's going to campaign everywhere. And they interview Joe Manchin, and Manchin says they don't have any plans. I think they didn't have any plans for Biden to come there. But he says, Biden's probably the only Democrat who could come here. And that was said when Biden went to Alabama to campaign for Doug Jones. Now, Cory Booker and Deval Patrick later did go. So let's not overstate.
But they went for turnout. They went more for turnout, right? I mean, they went at a time. They went for, the get out the vote period versus when did I don't know. Joe went down there, I think, earlier.
Joe went very early.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Joe went very early. Okay. It was definitely not a strictly let's turn out the black turnout campaign trip. You know, Biden can literally go anywhere. There's no state, there's no constituency, there's no demographic where you're going to say Biden's not the right guy for that. And just that notion that gets keep putting out there, Biden's the only guy that can do this. That's helpful. That's helpful to Biden. I know that there are people who are going to look, are going to roll their eyes and saying, please go away. Your time is done. You're going to be 78 in 2020. This is ridiculous. But the fact that Biden's going to be a very, very big presence, I think, throughout this year is only going to solidify the notion that he is going to be a formidable presence in the race.
I agree. Don't sleep on Joe Biden.
Now, Biden also made a comment, I think the one that's probably getting a bit more play, that he was asked, should Trump testify? And he said, well, if I was his lawyer, I would tell him not to testify because he has a problem with precision. And then he even went on to say, talking about the Democrats being treasonous and Trump's defenders saying he was making a joke, and Biden said he's the joke. So he's being very pointed about Trump's personal failures. But you have a column today, I think along the same lines, that it would be crazy for Trump to testify.
Yeah, I think that's true. Joe and Mika were trying to bait Trump into doing this, saying like, "What do his lawyers think he's not smart enough to, to testify?" And then people like I saw this from a lot of people, but Evan McMullen was basically saying like, "Look, if you have nothing to hide, if you're telling the truth, you've got nothing to fear. Why not testify?" And I just think that's super horrible advice. Both because, A, in fact, Donald Trump does have a problem with the truth, and I think he's entirely, look, Bill Clinton had to testify for 4 hours. I don't think Donald Trump could talk 4 hours without lying. He may be entirely innocent of the foundational, question over, like, say, collusion, but he would lie about something. And I think, precision, is a good word, maybe a euphemism, but that's part of it. Anybody could trip up, and that's my part two of this, where I have a problem with this. It is actually bad advice to tell, people that if you have nothing to hide, then you should go talk to the FBI, like, voluntarily.
Well, this
is really bad advice.
In my younger days, I worked in a PR firm, and often in so-called crisis management situations, PR firms work alongside law firms. In fact, often if a client's in trouble, a law firm will bring in a PR firm to say, look, there are things that we can't really counsel you on. You need a PR firm for that. But there's a natural tension between law firms and PR firms, because what makes sense legally doesn't make sense PR-wise in many cases.
Right.
So legally, it makes no sense for Trump to willingly testify. But politically, it's weird for Trump's own people to be publicly saying, oh, he's not, you can't trust he's going to tell the truth.
Right.
So he shouldn't be out there. That's not.
So instead they're making, because they know that that's bad optics, they're making the argument. So I guess two things. One, Trump is saying, look, of course I want to talk. I'd love to talk to Mueller, right? And then the lawyers are saying, we don't think that this rises to the standard of compelling a president to testify. And they've got a pretty good legal, there's an argument that you can't sort of haul a president before, to testify, like, when there's no, like, no crime.
But it would set
a bad precedent.
But isn't the precedent already set with Clinton and Paula Jones and Whitewater that you're not immune to that? So, Clinton was subpoenaed.
Yes, but I think there are other examples where sitting presidents like Reagan do the interrogatories written, and that's what I would be pushing for, a written response.
Well, I could understand Trump's people saying, we don't want to get formally subpoenaed. We could take it to court, but we could well lose, and then we're going to be hauled into a more rigid situation. I don't know if it's a guarantee that he would get videotaped. That's what happened to Clinton. He got subpoenaed and videotaped, right? Which is the worst possible thing, because that videotape's going to leak. So better to negotiate something lower key and informal that doesn't put you, you know, literally on under the Klieg lights. But my understanding now is that Trump is saying, Trump's people are saying, we don't want to talk to him at all.
No, I think they should make every effort to resist this. And see, this is my problem with the commentary, okay? So first of all, when I'm doing commentary, I'm thinking, let's be honest. I really want to put myself, personally, I have a bias toward Trump doing that. I would love Trump to do this, right? Personally, it'd be great TV. It'd be great, you know, commentary, great. So, and journalists should want transparency, right? But if I'm sort of saying, like, if I were Trump's attorneys, I would say there's no way you should do this. And I do think it's a problem when you have a lot of commentators putting out the notion that if you're innocent and if you tell the truth, you have nothing, you have no reason to fear talking to Mueller or the FBI or even the police. It's actually really horrible advice. It's very bad advice for average citizens to hear this, which I think that's my real concern, that there'll be like a spillover effect where people will believe this to be true. And the problem is, we believe that if I know I didn't do this crime, and if I know that I'm honest and I think I'm smart, I think I'm a good, look, I talk for a living, right? Of course I could talk to the police. Bad advice. They talk about lawyering up. That's what you should do.
Right. I mean, lawyering up is the correct strategy to enter into these sorts of proceedings with care and caution. But politically and PR wise, it looks like you're a tacit admission of guilt. Now that's
right.
unfair.
I think the people who are propagating the notion that if Donald Trump has nothing to hide, he should voluntarily do this are implicitly advancing the canard that choosing not to be stupid is an admission of guilt.
Right. And I agree with you fully on that. I do think Trump's situation is different than the average person, in that I think it is impossible for him to avoid testifying to Mueller in some capacity. And I because there's this division within his own legal team, I don't know if they're going to end up in a place where they get the softest possible interrogation. They may well, by trying to be tough guy, yeah, end up getting into the harshest possible interrogation, which would be the worst possible situation.
Could be, but I tell you, Bill, and you know this, I mean, it is entirely possible that Donald Trump is utterly innocent of anything to do with collusion, and he could still commit perjury very easily.
Yeah.
In a situation like this,
I mean,
and I don't want to, you know, they call it a perjury trap. Look, that implies, I think, I'm not an expert, a legal expert, I think that implies that Mueller is intentionally trying to set traps. I don't even think that's a prerequisite. I just think if you let anybody talk for 4 hours, or you make anybody talk for 4 hours, they could say something that is wrong. They could lie. And I think with Donald Trump, it's especially problematic.
Let me ask you about the memo fallout. So the Democratic memo might well get released. I don't know if, I suppose Trump could still block it, but it seemed like when I last read that they were looking to release it with redactions. Some people thought that the Republican memo was going to be a precursor to Trump firing Rosenstein, which has not happened yet, let alone firing Mueller. What do you think Trump's endgame here is? Is it to eventually fire one or both of them? Or is it to discredit and let them limp along, so once the work is done, the findings will be treated through a polarized political lens?
I mean, I don't know, and I don't know that they know that they actually even have a coherent strategy. My guess is it's the latter, that they're trying to muddy the waters, and that they're trying to basically just create a situation where people lose faith and trust in the entire investigation. Everybody's corrupt. Everybody, you know, yeah, but the FBI is not perfect either. Or they're doing what they're doing for political reasons. My guess is that that's what it is. That he's muddying the waters. Because honestly, the memo didn't have any. There was nothing in the memo that would actually justify a firing. And
but
so
does it even matter? Does the quality of the memo have any bearing to the political strategy of muddying in the waters? Because on Fox News, it's treated like this Rosetta Stone of the truth. Anyone who looks at it closely is like, there's actually nothing here. But it seems to be irrelevant because the breathless narrative exists in the feverish swamp in regards to what's the substance of the memo.
I don't get the memo at all. I think the memo was really kind of a waste of time and pointless. And it was the fact that it was overhyped, actually, I think, doesn't necessarily – it actually may hurt the cause. But I would say I think that there are some legitimate, you know, concerns at the FBI, some, you know, the appearance of impropriety, some conflicts of interest. And I do think that, you know, calling attention to that could serve to nullify what comes out of the Mueller investigation, that they could be used politically for that end. So, this goes back to what you were just saying about PR versus legal. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that means that Donald Trump's playing this PR game, but sometimes that is at odds with what the legal game is. And so it very, you know, if they have the legal goods on Donald Trump, you know, if there is an obstruction of justice or something that happens, you know, maybe you can work the refs a little bit and prevent impeachment. But at the end of the day, I think if they have the goods on Trump, then they have the goods on Trump. It doesn't matter how much he's muddied the waters.
Let me shift gears to what's going on this week in Congress, which is trying to keep the government open again. This is Wednesday morning. It's a bit of a moving target, so apologies if events have gotten past us. But it looks like – so the House has already passed its version of a continuing resolution, but gives the military, gives the Pentagon a longer budget lifeline. Democrats are trying to keep – the military and the non-military tracks linked. And apparently there is a Senate deal, bipartisan Senate deal, where they would have a two-year deal that would raise the budget cap. So we're still technically in the era of sequestration, which puts caps on what can be spent. They would raise those caps, roughly the same for military and non-military spending. Over the 2 years, it would add roughly $300 billion in new spending. It wouldn't spell out exactly where all that money goes, but it's the cap of what you can spend. And if that gets passed by the Senate, it would still have to get passed by the House to get to Trump's desk and sign the law by midnight Thursday. Now, my understanding is that the reason why the Senate shutdown ended before was that McConnell promised either you get an immigration deal with Trump by February 8th, or I will put a version of the legislation on the floor of the Senate and it'll get hashed out through regular order. People can add amendments and such. So you sort of have like this open process where who knows what exactly gets produced. And there's no guarantee if the House accepts it or Trump accepts it. But Democrats agreed to that deal. I read, I believe, in roll call that if this passes the Senate with this extra spending, you would lose the House Freedom Caucus, which makes Speaker Ryan dependent on Democratic votes to get that deal to Trump's desk. And if we don't know if Pelosi would extract a further demand to get those votes, the chief one being, you need to do what McConnell promised and put an immigration bill on the floor, too. I don't know if you have a sense of where you think this is headed, if you think this is going to get to Trump's desk, if we're going to have a shutdown, if this is how immigration is going to play out. I mean, my personal sense is that Ryan would have to accept that deal. He doesn't want a shutdown. McConnell doesn't want a shutdown. Trump says he wants to shut down, but that might have just been popping off. And
Ryan promised when he became the speaker, he would not do anything on immigration that didn't have a majority of the majority. He would not bring anything to the floor. So that handcuffs him.
And I think he's also said he doesn't want to put something on the floor that Trump doesn't support. And this would be agreeing to a process where you don't know the final product. You're starting something you don't know where it finishes. So it's not quite as putting something on the floor that people oppose. It's putting something on the floor that you don't know if they're going to oppose or not. And a risk that you end up producing something that Trump vetoes, which would make Republicans really mad because they don't want to get cross wires with Trump, especially immigration. The most recent Gallup poll showed Trump's support amongst Republicans at 90%. These people are terrified of being seen as disloyal to Trump. At the same time, Trump has said he'd be for a compromise. You pass it. If you get something to my desk, I'll take the heat.
Yeah, no, that's the problem with Trump is he says, I mean, you could quote him accurately sounding like a complete open-minded kind of moderate. And then, but the next day he'll completely say something different. I mean, and so it's really, what is it, the negotiating with Jell-O
right,
line?
Right.
It's really hard.
I feel if I was Ryan, I think I could say to myself, I'm going to put this on Trump's desk, put the spending bill on Trump's desk, knowing that he's not going to literally want to be the sole reason for a shutdown. Here is a bipartisan bill that passed both houses of the Congress. There's no blame shifting if you shut down the government at this point. Don't think he'd want to do that. And as they discuss immigration on the floor of the House and Senate, Trump still has a voice. He can say, hey, you put that amendment in there, I'm going to veto. And that would scare Republicans off. So it's not like he can't shape the final bill still.
But this spending thing, I just want to say on this. This is another short-term fix, right? I mean, we're going to be talking about this a month from now again.
Well, I'm a little confused about the particulars of what's going to be in the Senate version because I think
there's a chance there could be a long-term fix, I guess.
Well, I think it's both. Like, I think technically it's still like a month-long CR with the actual spending amounts for the specific agencies. But an agreement on the long-term budget cap, which would make it easier to do something more longer term come March. I think that's what it is.
But still, we'll be right back here in March.
I mean, there's a mild risk of that, but I think the clear appetite on both sides is not to have shutdowns. And if you have an agreement on the overall spending limits, it would seem hard to have another snag.
That's why I listen to the DMZ to find out stuff like this.
But do you have a sense of where? I mean, I feel like Republicans are very divided on immigration. I think Trump's divided with it himself. On one hand, they want to play to the anti-immigrant base. On the other hand, DACA itself is wildly popular, even amongst Republicans. DACA is more of a 50-50 issue than a 100-0 against. So, do you have a sense of where they want this to end up?
I mean, honestly, I've been following it very closely in the past week or so, but I think Trump's framework actually has a shot, which, just to sort of remind people, would grant, it would take care of like more than a million Dreamers, and it would provide a pathway to citizenship in exchange. It would in chain, quote unquote, chain migration, and it would fully fund a wall. Like so maybe this is a question for you. Why is there no effort to put that on the floor?
Well, I think that's what would go on the floor, or something along those lines. Whether it's exactly that or if it's,
but this is Trump's. I mean, Trump has laid out the framework. This isn't John McCain. Marco Rubio.
I don't know exactly what bill would get put on the Senate floor to start the process. Maybe they would take the Graham-Durbin bill and start there, then someone would have the amendment with all the Trump stuff and then put that on, it would supplant it. But it's all in the framework of DACA plus border security. and then you're now you're haggling over price tags and scope. So I think both McConnell and Ryan can go to Trump and say, look, this is all a way to get the deal that you proposed or something along those lines. It's not something that's going to be going off in some wholly different direction.
So let me just ask you, we've had this discussion a bunch of times. Where are you on that? Let's take the whole frame that Trump proposed. He talked about it last week. It feels like a month ago, but last week was the State of the Union. Could Democrats not support that? Could they walk away from protecting the Dreamers because it funds the wall or whatever?
Well, you certainly have on the left an attempt to move the goalposts away from the Trump deal. You have immigration activists saying this is a white supremacist ransom note and things like that. But it's going to be pretty hard for Democrats to spike a deal that gives Dreamers citizenship. I mean, that's not even just staying in limbo. It's a path to citizenship. I can't say exactly what Democrats are going to be willing to accept or not accept, but you can see that deal being made. You can see Schumer and Pelosi going to immigration activists and saying, look, we had to accept some things that we didn't like here, but we had to save the Dreamers. You asked us to save the Dreamers. This started because you said it was imperative to save the Dreamers, and that's what we did.
I know, that's why I feel like Democrats are boxed in on this, and I think so. I've written very sort of optimistically about this deal, and I think there could be some good to come from it. I mean, if the border is secured, probably if the economy if the economy stays strong, that helps too. But if the border is secured, you could have a situation where people are the populist base are less antagonistic and more sort of generous in terms of granting a pathway to citizenship to other undocumented immigrants. So I think this could actually end up being a good thing, but I don't know where it goes from here, logistically to actually, I need to follow up on this, obviously. Let's do a two-parter this week. All right, so we have a tweet from John R. Parkinson of ABC. Nancy Pelosi announces she'll oppose emerging bipartisan caps deal without commitment from Speaker Ryan to match McConnell's pledge for future open consideration of immigration. Absent that, the package does not have my, quote, does not have my support or support of a large number of our caucus.
And so I think that that throws down the gauntlet, as we talked about before. I think Ryan's going to need Democratic votes. Pelosi's named her price. I think that's a price that Ryan is going to have to pay. I think he can go to Trump and say, look, I don't have a guarantee how this process is going to play out, but I think we can influence this so we get a deal that's to your liking, and I think you can draw your red line throughout this process. And if you say this provision's a no-go with you, trust me, Republicans won't put it in the bill. We still have the majority of the House and the Senate. We can decide what gets in there or not.
Well, I'm just glad that Twitter has expanded the character limit. Otherwise, we would have never been able to read that tweet.
All right, I want to one last topic. Now, I have a piece in the queue. I don't think it's published yet over at Politico. So over the course of the past several days, when most of the media attention has been on the memo, there was there was news from I think both Treasury and CBO have released deficit projections for fiscal year this fiscal year, which say the deficit's going to nearly double from last year. So it was $514 billion last year. It's headed towards $955 billion. nearing $1 trillion, and that's after the tax cut passed.
This isn't the debt. This is the deficit.
This is the annual budget deficit. This is now accumulated debt is still at over 100% of GDP. So the debt is slightly larger than the size of the entire economy. And as it was moving in that direction, back in 2011, Paul Ryan said in the State of the Union response, we're at a tipping point where the debt is going to, you know, consume the entirety of the national economy. And he put that as sort of like, we're going to become Greece if this happens. Now, this already happened. I actually saw, you know, one of the more ridiculous pro-Trump sites, Gateway Pundit, put out a piece just a few days ago that said, Trump's the first president ever to reduce the size of the national debt, because it went down from 105% of GDP to 104% of GDP, which is a rounding error in the size of the debt. But and I saw Bill Mitchell as one of the more, you know, pro-Trump tweeters, you know, push that out as well. I mean, the truth is that nothing has happened to the size of the debt. It's basically where it was. It's still historically very large. However, it hasn't been proven that this destroys us as a nation. The economy is still doing well. And Trump is now, with the tax cut, massively expand the deficit in a very short period of time. And we're on the verge of a spending deal, which is going to add even more to the deficit. About $150 billion this year, $150 billion next year, which would probably put over $1 trillion for this year. So my piece, a two-pronged premise. One, this is going to reshape the political battlefield. So over the Obama years, we had Republicans saying, oh my lord, we're going to become Greece, so all is collapsing around us, this is a disaster. Then they nominate Trump, who calls himself the king of debt, who says he's not going to touch Social Security and Medicare, he wants to double Hillary Clinton on infrastructure. And so there's already a tacit admission from Republicans, you know, we really don't care. That really isn't our thing, debt deficit. We talk about it a lot. We never actually do anything about it. Then Trump gets into office. He proposes a budget with Mick Mulvaney, which would totally decimate domestic spending. But it's a DOA budget. They don't really care about themselves. They don't take their own budget very seriously. We're probably going to endorse the spending increase, you know, in a matter of days. So Democrats are starting to attack Republicans for increasing the deficit. You had in the tax cut debate, you know, Schumer and Pelosi. It was Pelosi said, we are mortgaging our children and grandchildren's future to pass tax cuts for the wealthy. Bernie Sanders. Remember in the Obama years, the left was all Democrats are taking the deficit too seriously. There's too much austerity talk. Bernie Sanders said in his State of the Union response, his unofficial response, the tax cut gives 83% of the benefits to the wealthy and increases the deficit by $1.7 trillion. Jeff Merkley, who endorsed Sanders for president, he had a tweet saying, I'm old enough to remember when Republicans cared about the deficit. So both wings of the Democratic Party are hammering this notion that Republicans are deficit hypocrites and tacitly suggesting that it is bad to increase the deficit this much. So this is where I think things get dicey for Democrats. I think it's totally true. Republicans are utterly hypocritical and intellectually bankrupt on debt and deficit. And it's worth pointing that out. But as Dick Cheney said, Reagan proved deficits don't matter. There's no reason to believe that people by November are going to care that the deficit has increased. If people feel like the tax cuts put more money in their pocket, they do not care that it is an increased deficit at the same time. And the longer term risk for Democrats is, I mean, even you know, the economy may go south, as the stock market spasm was a warning sign of, and you could perhaps tie that to the tax cut bill. You overheated the economy. You prompted the Fed to accelerate interest rates. You sparked inflation, and that's hurt us all. And increased deficit is part of that. You can make that case. But now you're hemming yourself in once you're in power. You want to do free college. You want to do expanded preschool. You want to have anti-poverty measures. Now you've already acknowledged that the deficit is bad and you need to tame it. Now you can't do the things that you want to do. So I think Democrats need to be very careful how they approach the issue.
Well, and you and I both know they'll say it's the tax cuts that caused this, and the military, you know. Whereas Republicans are going to claim it's entitlement spending. So, you know, that's both sides will be hypocritical.
Well, and as they have been for a very long time. But I mean, here's a chance for Democrats to not be hypocritical and basically say, look, let's all agree. It has been proven that, one, Republicans don't care about the deficit, and two, when it has been elevated, it hasn't brought about the apocalypse that they have predicted. So we don't. That's not a reason to be profligate. We don't need to spend us into oblivion, but you don't need to go into hysterics because we've proposed spending that's going to help you.
So you're basically saying it's tempting for Democrats to scare the public about deficits, and they should resist that temptation. They could talk about the hypocrisy of Republicans, but they shouldn't use this as a cudgel to worry the public about, you know, big spending Republicans.
Well, the great temptation is that there are going to be some right-leaning voters who do care about debt and deficit that they could win over to their side. So if you speak in fiscally conservative terms, that maybe you can expand your political base. And that could well work in the short term if the economy was bad. If the economy was good, no one's going to care at all. But I think there's if you're expanding your coalition on that basis, you're now complicating your ability to pass the items that are important to you.
So, you know, you're not an economist, I'm not an economist, but it just stands to reason that if a nation goes into debt and accumulates big deficits, that at some point something bad is going to happen. Why is it that America has basically been immune from this gravity?
Well, I mean, the big reason why America is different than Greece is that we can print our own money. Greece can't. They had to beg the EU for a bailout because they couldn't take care of their own fiscal issues. Now, the one example I have of when deficits did prove to be a problem was in the Reagan-Bush years. So Reagan runs deficits through most of his presidency, but the economy is going gangbusters and nobody cares. But at the very end, inflation starts to rise. And so the Fed kicks in with higher interest rates. And the interest rate hike precipitates the recession of 1990. When you have a recession, you want to have a deficit. You want Keynesian stimulus. That is the proper time to put your foot on the gas pedal. And if you're already in deficit, you can't easily do that. And so Bush says, George Bush Sr. says, I need to do a tax hike deal with the Democrats so the Fed will lower interest rates again, which he does. And the Fed does follow suit. And the recession actually ends on his watch. But he gets zero credit for it. The Republicans are mad he broke his pledge on taxes. The ripple effects of the recession are still in the economy by 1992, so no one believes that the recession is actually over. And he ends up losing re-election. But it's not that the deficit itself... the deficit had an indirect role in causing a recession. It was a brief recession. It was a recession that was addressed and was able to be addressed, but just kind of awkward and painful in how you went about it. So it's just not the same as the debt and the deficit destroyed everything, but you can get yourself into a bad spot where you don't have the fiscal ammo that you would like to have in a pinch.
There's no doubt that there's this hypocrisy. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I heard Paul Ryan say, you know, if we don't tackle this deficit or debt, the debt's going to tackle us. And now they're in charge, and, you know,
there's still a sort of unknown question as sort of how much is too much. I mean, our debt to GDP ratio is, I think, the highest it's ever been. And that is a byproduct. So Obama had to do massive Keynesian stimulus to mitigate the impact of the 2008 crash, which has done its job. And Obama even then, working with Republicans, you could say whether it's by his own good nature, by because he was boxed in, whatever, the fact is, they did sequestration. They did reduce annual budget deficits. They were at about 9% of GDP at the beginning of Obama's term with the Recovery Act. They got down to 3% of GDP by the end of his term, which was the target that Obama himself set out and that the Simpson-Bowles Commission set out. So mission accomplished in shrinking that deficit to a manageable size. But you still have accumulated debt that occurred over that period that you're not going to reduce until you start paying it down. Until you actually are running budget surpluses, you can't pay down accumulated debt. So if you believe that this debt level has some kind of potential negative impact down the line, you're going to be panicky and want to cut more to get to that place. But we've had that level of debt now for, I think, 3 or 4 years. Excuse me if my numbers aren't exactly right. I mean, at minimum, it hasn't caused apocalypse yet. That might be, I might have blinders on, but no one really knows what exactly is this magical number that would be too much. It's already seemingly past the threshold, and it hasn't been too much.
And on that happy note,
I guess we should leave it there.
Let me just say, invest in gold, stockpile water.
Bitcoin. Bitcoin's always good.
Always, yeah.
Till next week, sir. Special Valentine's Day, Snow Day 2 episode.
Yes. In the arms of the angel. We need some music playing now. Follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show and check us out back here next week.
All right. Take care.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.